Today, I'm deeply honored to speak with novelist, essayist, and scholar Yuri Herrera about his new novel, Season of the Swamp, which is a deeply researched and dazzlingly imagined account of Benito Juarez's time spent in exile in New Orleans. We talk about what that time and place offered to Juarez's understanding of the world coming into being, one of creolité and a carnival, of mixedness and multiplicity, and what these sometimes hallucinatory moments offered his political vision. We talk about what kinds of new visions of freedom are discovered in the midst of forms of slavery that horrify Juarez. Very importantly, we relate all of this to the present day, to the genocide in Gaza, the violent ICE attacks in the United States, and the descent into unbridled and unmasked fascism. We are especially grateful to Yuri for reading from his novel and talking in depth about the importance of mixed languages and the new social worlds they reflect. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. So, welcome to the show, Yuri. I'm so honored to have you on because I've admired your work for a long time. The novels are great teaching texts because they open up the imagination in really specific ways. But I thought I'd begin with personal appreciation of Season of the Swamp because I really keyed in on your notion of political opposition work in exile taking place at particular times in particular spaces, and that being really important. And I came up in the 60s, and my first college experience was at San Francisco State. And a lot of my professors, my favorite professors, were leftist Greek journalists who had been expelled in the 67 junta. And they were teaching everything, like Baudelaire and Poe and poetry. And this is also the time of the Third World Liberation Strike and the American Federation of Teachers strike. So San Francisco at that point was really a vibrant space, not just for the issues of Greece, but also Iran, also, of course, the Philippines. And I do you know this novel by Bienvenido Santos? He was in the Philippine government in exile in Washington, D.C., along with playwrights Severino Montano and Jose Garcia Villa. And he writes this novel. The tone strikes me as similar to Season of the Swamp, is that sort of tragic comic. It's called Why the Hell For You Left Your Heart in San Francisco. And it's about this group of expatriate Filipinos who are there doing all manner of things, engaging with different facets of life, much like Season of the Swamp. And they start this magazine, this Philippine cultural magazine. And the theme of the magazine is, how can Filipino culture exist in exile? And the material support for the magazine comes from a Filipino doctor whose specialty is performing vasectomies. So the whole irony of these notions of culture and politics existing both in and out of the home state is really interesting to me. So maybe we could begin by asking you, why did you write this Season of the Swamp? What attracted you to this particular interlude in Juarez's life? And maybe give us a little bit of background as to the historical context.
Benito Juarez is a really important figure in Mexico, Mexican culture, politics, history. He's probably the most respected figure in that sense in Mexico, only akin to what is maybe Lincoln in the American culture. Benito Juarez was an orphan in the state of Oaxaca. He spoke a variant of Zapotec, an indigenous language. He was raised a little bit by a sister. Then someone sent him to a seminar. He was going to become a priest, but in his own words, he felt repulsed by the things that the way the priests were manipulating the people. in Oaxaca. So he then became a lawyer. Afterwards, he was a congressman, and he was a governor, and he was a judge. And by the moment this story happens, he is not a public servant anymore. He's just a professor in the Instituto de Artes. But years before, he had become enemy of the now dictator Santa Anna, who is the guy who pretty much lost the territories to the United States. Mm. And this guy has a grudge with him. As we know, these crazy, powerful people hold grudges, and then they try to take revenge. So he gets him arrested, sends him to Veracruz, and he's gonna be exiled in Europe. But he gets off the boat in Havana. And from Havana, he comes to New Orleans to wait out, to start conspiring with other people. Now, this whole story that I just told you, it's in pretty much every biography, but just in a couple of lines, or in a couple of paragraphs, or in one page.
Yeah.
And every biography recognizes that he learned something really important during his time in New Orleans.
Yeah.
But nobody knows what happens. And what people usually say is that it was the influence of another exile, Melchor Ocampo, made him so sharp and so ready, because after New Orleans, he came back to Mexico and immediately became Minister of Justice and started the separation between church and state. And then he became president, and then he was heading the resistance against the French. But this is pretty much unknown. Oh. It's only people who pay attention to these details. When I arrived here, I realized that he had been here, and I just had it in the back of my mind all these years. And after maybe 10 years, I started thinking that this was something for which I was ready now in different ways. One, that I had a political relation with New Orleans, that I was not just passing by, that I was not a newcomer anymore, because this is a very complex city. A lot of people love to talk about it, but mostly a lot of people talk about just the partying and Bourbon Street and the cliches. And I thought that I had a more complex relation. And that also, this gave me the opportunity to go back to a topic that has been very important for me throughout my life, which is that of migration. Juarez was like an extreme migrant in the sense that he was exiled, that he was persecuted. But I could understand a little bit what could have been his astonishment when he arrived in the city, similar to what I felt here, a city that is usually codified just as a black and white city, whereas there is a lot more in here. It's always a little bit of a mystery how you pick topics to write about. It's a combination of what you feel ready to write, what you want to write besides being ready or not, and the materials you have. Mm. And the materials in this case were the knowledge that I had about Benito Juarez, the knowledge that I had about the city, and the clash that I thought that putting these two elements together would create something interesting.
Yeah. You anticipated the question I was going to ask later on in the podcast, which is that I did sense a strong autobiographical element in there. And one of the lines I want to follow throughout the podcast is these different time frames, right? You talk about the present, but also Juarez and what he's reacting to in the past, recent past in New Orleans, all these things that are bubbling up in New Orleans. And if Signs Preceding the End of the World was a lot about movement and moving across various tableaus, there's a lot of stasis and intensity. It's almost claustrophobic at times in the Season of the Swamp. And two words just popped out about the way you describe that world. One is criollité and the other is carnival. The notion of mixedness and role switching over and over again. And a lot of what artists is processing is how things shape shift all the time. The people can occupy different kinds of positions. Could you talk about how this feeds into his political vision? What kinds of things he's starting to react with in the environment, that people, places, music, even food, animals. Yeah.
Juarez was an extraordinarily well-educated person because he had been for several years in the seminar, and then he studied law, and he was even a physics professor.
Oh.
And he was very well-versed in the French philosophers. He was a man of the Enlightenment. He knew Latin, and he knew Zapotec and Spanish, and he could read French, but he could not read or speak English. And he had, before this time, never been out of Mexico.
Mm.
So this was really a very intense landing in a place that even today it sometimes feels like improbable.
Yeah.
And if you can imagine what it was 170 years ago,
exactly,
this must have been like really landing in a different planet where there were this array of languages being spoken. Still, there were indigenous language being spoken, not a lot, not in public life, but the indigenous people were still around the city, and they would come every year to the city, and they even held ceremonies with the authorities.
Yeah.
And you have exiles from many places. And this strange mix of the different Black population that were here, because usually people talk about Black culture as if it was one single thing.
Exactly, yeah.
But what you had here was a lot of enslaved people from different parts in Africa. And then you had a lot of people from Haiti that had come in different moments since the Haitian Revolution, exiles from Cuba and from Mexico especially. So all this, I think, showed all the exiles what a cosmopolitan place could be. And cosmopolitan not just because there were educated people in the European ways, but cosmopolitan in a very broad way that was very aligned with what these exiles were thinking, which was we have to create our own identity and our own version of the country, not just following what the Europeans dictate. So there were many things, but yes, one of the things that I think was most important is, and of course there's no proof, it's just something that I think it's absolutely plausible, like powerfully plausible, is the ideological influence that New Orleans music could have had on them. Because you had here a confluence of African music that was not in that moment not respected or recognized as such, but that it was already a super important present and that eventually would change the way in which the entire world understand music. And the other hand, you had very intense European classical music life in New Orleans with several opera companies. So when you have this, when you have hundreds of enslaved people that on Sundays we get together on Congo Square, in the what is today called Louis Armstrong Park, playing the drums for hours and hours. And just a few blocks from there, you have these operas, these companies staging operas that were composed sometimes 1 or 2 years before. What you have then is really an accidental avant-garde when you mix it. And probably the people in power, the white people, didn't recognize this. And probably the Black people were not allowed to see it as influential, their culture as it was. But what I think is that someone like Juarez, who was himself originally a marginal person and who was radical in terms of the times, he could have seen like there is something new happening here.
Yeah,
it's just not expressed in a book. It's just not expressed in philosophical terms. But there is a new way of thinking that comes from this clash that is already on the works. And of course, jazz would happen 70 years later, but the elements were already there and what it could be. So this is one of my ideas that is not explicit in the novel because I always expect the reader to come up with it, that this city provided certain space of imagination that was not there in the schools or the political philosophies over the time.
Yeah, no, I think one of the first images of music that you have in the novel is, it's not just one piano, it's 10 pianos. this idea of multiplicity and variance. And then one of the last ones is when Benito and Thisbe dance. It's a beautiful scene, right, in which this tension and their relationship, which is very complex, unfolds at the very end, and it's very respectful and at the same time kind of sensual. It's very wonderfully done. And as you were speaking, I was thinking another key word is simply freedom. Can you talk a little bit about how New Orleans presented? You already did some sense, but I wanted to give you that particular keyword to work with for a little bit.
That is a very complex thing. One of the problems of Benito Juarez in Mexican history is that when he separated church and state, it was a very important thing to do because church, the Catholic Church, was holding more than half the wealth of the country. So it was, in fact, just keeping the country poor while they were just sustaining their position, the same position that they had during the colonial times. Now, another thing that the church was doing back then was that they served as an umbrella for different indigenous communities across the country that have been able to preserve their ways of organization more or less and their hierarchies and things like that. The reforms that happened then under Juarez's guidance meant that Mexico was going to be a country of individuals instead of a country of corporations. And these communities were under the guidance of this big corporation that was the Catholic Church. So this is one of the things that have been problematic that many people still today was a mistake by Juarez. Yeah. The way I understand it in light of this experience, and this is one of the things that are documented from of their trip here, is that these exiles were just amazed of the amount of commerce that was happening in New Orleans, that there were not all these tariffs and taxes and whatever, and that there was a lot of wealth happening because of the port, how intense and how rich it was. So it was an example of economic freedom. Then, at the same time, what they witnessed was the other side, not a mistake, but an integral part of the same system, which was slavery, that used people as objects, as property. And this is also documented in their comments, is what, some of the few things that they said when they went back, that they were absolutely horrified, because slavery had not existed in Mexico since the beginning of the independence. And they were absolutely horrified. So I think that this gave them, and they gave quite a specific, this conviction that individual freedom was absolutely crucial in the creation of a new form of state. And one of the things that I say in the novel, when he witnesses an execution, he says the law is so terrible that it has to be the same for all. Which is something that was very important in the reforms that they started, taking away privileges to the army, to the church, things like that. But at the same time, that created certain problems in indigenous communities. But yes, what I think they could have seen in New Orleans was the need of economic freedom and the need to guarantee that every individual has power over their own destiny.
Yeah. And you do such a great job of showing the immensity of the choices that they're making. They're trying out different things. And at the end, you have the culmination of one of the major plot lines of Borrego, making this interesting calculation about revenge and advantage and economics in a way that is quite imaginative in some ways and interesting in the way that he processes this. And even dreams, you have Benito having two dreams.
Yeah.
And I especially like the second one because he's dreaming through another person. He's dreaming through Ocampo. Yeah. Could you talk about those two dreams and the difference between them and this sort of plays out that theme?
One of the dreams has to do with rationality, with the way he's understanding how the world is rational and the world can be explained all through reason, and how that is, it can be a sort of a trap. But yeah, you're right. The second one is the one about, by the way, before writing it, all I had about it was the title. I just loved the title, and I decided that I was going to write something that had to do with the title, which is Melchor Ocampo, Socialist Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. Melchor Ocampo had been governor of Michoacán. He had been adopted as a newborn by a very rich family. So he received, let's say, an aristocratic education. He was, in terms of those times, he was a sort of socialist, what Marx would call a utopian socialist. You used to read a lot of the French utopian socialists, and some people say he was one of the first people to translate Marx into Spanish. But he was a liberal in the sense of that this word was understood back then, not in the way we understand it right now. A classic liberal thinking about especially the English philosophers. So he had these two things. He was the most educated of all the exiles, and yeah, he was supposed to have been a great influence in Juarez. But instead of over-explaining this, I thought that this would be a good example to do something fun and to say some things about the city and about the culture created around the city while explaining their relations. And the thing is, in this dream, Ocampo is, let's say, battles a couple of vampires. But those vampires, besides being vampires in the dream, they are people who exploit people of color, who are cruel, who are literally sucking their blood in the sense that it has happened in this city throughout the centuries, that there has been not only during slavery, but in other moments, a lot of exploitation, a lot of cruelty. And there's many cases of horrible things happening in the plantations, which in themselves were already concentration camps. Had horrible examples of extreme cruelty to the servants and the enslaved people. And this city has turned all the tragedy and all those horrible things happened to its inhabitants into something different. People in New Orleans hate the word resilience because that tends to mean we can do whatever we want to you and you will come back.
Yeah.
And I will think it's more a rebellious. So all that thing has turned into subversive way of occupying the streets, owning the streets, of having a party with any pretext, and of having different ways to express that violence. So one of the pop expressions by someone that was not black, obviously, but that understood this, was Anne Rice, who wrote all these novels about vampires.
Right. Yeah,
and she's not the only one who written about this thing, and there are different examples. So I thought this would be a good way of explaining how this is. Ocampo was an important character. He's a sort of hero. But since it's in a dream, I can do whatever I want with it. And yeah, I think that was one of the fun parts of the book. I like it.
No, and it has the best last line, which I'm not going to say because I want the readers to experience it for themselves originally. It's such a great last line for that dream.
Yeah.
And again, the fact that you have Benito dreaming his dream and refracting it through that fantasy. I invited you to read a passage or two or as many as you want because I always love to have authors read their own work because the way they voice their writing is so important.
Actually, I was going to read about the passage that you mentioned before when he sees the... And whenever I read in English, I feel that I have to, again, mention my translator, Lisa Dillman. I think translators, in general, are some of the most important people in the world right now. They are trying to make sense of what is said in one place and really, with their body and their understanding, put it in another language, which is something that AI can't do. AI is just a stupid algorithm, whereas translators are people who actually understand meanings and feelings. And always when I meet a translator, as when I meet social workers, I want to say thank you for your service. Those are the people who really we should be thanking for their services, not people sent to kill people overseas.
I've had various people, for example, Palestinian poets, read in Arabic. I would love, if you felt like it, read in Spanish first and then in English. That would be great. But it's up to you. Yeah.
The thing is, it's three pages, so it would be too long maybe if I read it in both languages.
Maybe just the first couple paragraphs in Spanish.
Okay. I have it here in English. Let me get that.
Okay.
I'm going to read the first two paragraphs in Spanish and then the three pages in English.
Wonderful. Fantastic.
Lo último que se le aparece con claridad fue aquella noche cuando volvía del taller y pasó frente a un teatro, al que entraban y del que salían dos corrientes de gente claramente distintas. Formal la que salía, hombres de sombrero sensato, mujeres que antes de pisar la banqueta se quitaban las zapatillas para no arruinarlas. Más coloridad de caras y de ropa, la que entraba y como contoneándose. ¿Sabe por qué no se dijo ni por un segundo que cómo, que no, que a sus años? Nomás se hizo chiquito, literalmente se hizo chiquito, como lo era cuando llegó a Oaxaca sin saber modales ni Castilla y se metió donde no lo llamaban, a curiosear o a comer sin que lo vieran. Si algo había descubierto entonces y comprobado el resto de su vida, era que no bastaba hacerse invisible, que había que hacerle creer a los señores que también era invidente, para que no se sintieran tocados ni por el roce de una pestaña. Se escurrió entre los que ya habían pagado y entró al teatro. Al teatro, no al teatro. Debía de haber una ópera, pero había terminado temprano para eso. Un salón enorme, en el que habría 10, 20, 30, no más, como 30 y tantas parejas bailando cuadrilles y luego bailando polcas y luego bailando mazurcas. Alrededor del baile había mesas a las que casi nadie se sentaba, con gente coqueteando alrededor, tragos en mano. Había otros salones, brazos del salón mayor, con más mesas, pero a esas la gente sí se sentaba a jugar juegos y a seguir coqueteando, y todo el mundo estaba borracho. Okay. So, I'm going to read that in English. It's a little bit more than 3 pages.
That's fine. Okay? Absolutely.
Okay. So I was saying my translator is Lisa Dillman, who is a professor of translation at Emory University in Atlanta. The last thing he recalls with any clarity is the night he was coming back from the printshop and passed the theater with two distinct streams of people entering and exiting. Those exiting, formal, men in sensible hats, women who removed shoes before setting foot on the sidewalk so as not to soil them. Those entering, more colorful, both faces and attire, and a sort of strut. He knows why he didn't say, even for a second, "No, sir, not me, not at my age," and instead simply shrank, literally shrank, made himself as small as he had been when he first went to Oaxaca, with no manners and no Spanish, and snuck in where he wasn't wanted, to have a little look-see, or a little something to eat, without being seen. If there was one thing he'd learned, and then spent the rest of his life reconfirming, it was that making yourself invisible wasn't enough, that in addition to ensuring you're unseen, you have to convince the lords and ladies you are unseeing, so they don't feel touched by so much as the brush of your eyelash. He slipped in among those who'd paid to enter the theater, not the theater, where an opera must have ended early to make way for this. An enormous salon where there were probably 10, 20, 30, no more, 30-some couples dancing quadrilles and then polkas and then mazurkas. All around the hall were tables at which almost no one sat. Instead, people stood flirting, drinks in hand. There were other halls too, offshoots of the big ballroom with more tables where people did sit to gamble and keep flirting. And absolutely everyone was drunk. He got out of there quick, despite longing to stay, as had so often happened in places not intended for him. The excess, this terrible excess, the glittering excess, impossible to stay, impossible to leave. What devotion to excess could possibly surpass this? A block away was another theater. This time, he didn't even feel the fear of transgression. just shrank himself and blended in with the crowd. And this one actually was a concert hall. No dancing soirees here. But on the first floor, there was no way to blend in with the wall. A sentry stopped him on his way in, pointing to the stairs. He walked up to the gallery. The stage was filled with a single instrument, 10 of them, all the same, pianos, 10 pianos, 9 in a semicircle, each with its respective pianist seated on a stool, and the last in the center, unoccupied. What on earth? A man in frock coat came out on stage and bowed before the audience, who applauded feverishly, though he'd yet to do a thing. Gottschalk, someone beside him said in reverence. He knew the man's name, but not his deeds. Gottschalk took a seat at the first piano and began to play timidly, like someone peeping through a door, and then cross-handed some dainty notes, like someone hoping lightly through the door, then immediately gained confidence, like one gaining confidence, and began running his hands up and down the entire keyboard as if anxious that someone might steal a key, and then he made a sudden sign and a second piano began to telegraph a dreamier melody, until it took note of the first one and joined in, and one by one the other pianos also began to join in chaotically, until finally they synced up in one patriotic song, and the entire audience stood singing, hands to hearts, and then abruptly, 9 pianos fell silent, and Gottschalk started to play the overture to Don Giovanni, and was interrupted by the second piano playing the overture to Norma, and the audience laughed, and the musicians all started playing at once, the way they had at the coffee shop, but this time it was pianos, 10 pianos, playing different overtures. It was just like at the coffee shop, one continuous absurd song. Gottschalk would silence some pianos and authorize others, one by one, all 10 of them, without stopping. The audience clapped and shouted whenever they wanted, becoming part of the concert. He'd never seen anything like it. Who had ever seen anything like it? I was one of those. There is something else, but I think that's the excerpt that you were referring.
Right. No, it's, there's so much going on there. And just instinctively, when I hear, it's one thing to read it. It's another thing to hear you read it out loud. Marvelous reading, because the magic comes out in that the amplitude, it's this garish exhibition of affluence. And then what's particularly eerie about what you read was the crowd, they're part of the spectacle. They make themselves.
It's a democratization of art in that sense. And it's something that was not that common in that sense, that you would create a piece that it wasn't just a piece for the crowd, but the crowd somehow was being part of it.
Yeah. How did you create that? Because I'm thinking that you are, again, it's almost like Benito seeing through Ocampo's eyes. You're seeing through Benito's eyes. How did you put yourself in that position?
About this specific piece, there's a Gottschalk is someone who wrote down his music, and afterwards it was recorded, so we have access to that. Mm. I also read parts of his biography. He took a lot of notes, and there are like also chronicles about this kind of concerts. They were called monster concerts. Mm. But besides that, what is important is what you just said, which is Benito's gaze. And for this, there was a decision that I made at the beginning of the process, which is that I wasn't going to rely on his name, because his name is too heavy.
Yeah.
It's like his name is the name of a statue that exists in every single town in Mexico and in most towns, and not in most, but many towns around the world, including here in Orleans. There's a huge statue. In California, there are statues of Benito Juarez. He's the name of multiple streets, avenues, towns. What I needed was the character that is still not yet a statue, is still not yet a founding father.
Yeah.
But this man who suddenly finds himself being a kid again, because again, he doesn't know the language of the place where he arrived. Again, he's in a world he doesn't understand, just in the same way that happened to him when he walked from his small town to Oaxaca capital. And this seeing the world through this kind of gaze would allow me to build a tender character, a character that would be open to possibilities, that would be open to being moved by the world he's discovering. Not just a politician conspiring and rereading all the texts that they would be writing for themselves, but someone who's really understanding something in this world and that is doing something with that to let it transform himself.
Now, two things. One is that it also democratizes his vision, right? It's not only him, but other people can participate in that experience. And I was interested to hear you say what you did about his name, because every once in a while, as I was reading the book for the first time, I had to stop and think, is this Benito? Because he remains buried in so many ways that you do exactly what you say you want to do, which is to take away the monument and let that vision become broader than just that enshrined figure. I was going to take you back to Signs and read a passage from there that I think I mentioned to you when we met, because it resonates with this notion of interregnum of which Gramsci speaks. And you write, "More than the midpoint between homegrown and Anglo, their tongue is a nebulous territory between what is dying out and what is not yet born." So we find similar kinds of notions of an in-between time in Season of the Swamp. So I wanted to ask you if you could talk about comparative interregnums between what's going on in Signs and what's going on in Season, and if you'd like to talk about our own interregnum. What do you see happening in the U.S. and in Mexico now in terms of history?
That passage has to do with the way in which language are mixing to create something new. And very often people say that what is happening with the mixture of English and Spanish is just a third stable, rigid thing that some people call Spanglish. I have a problem with that definition of Spanglish because it implies that there are two stable versions of English and Spanish. When you have multiple versions of Spanish coming in here and multiple versions of English developing here, and the mixtures can be really interesting. And I think what that is happening in that moment is a fascination with that, with what living languages can become. And they are living languages because they don't depend on the dictionary, on they don't depend on the school, but they are living on people.
What kind of process is going on in Season of the Swamp? You also talk a lot about language in Season of the Swamp as not only a thing in itself, but also as a social world.
Benito Juarez is someone who is living in between because he is not the sort of powerful person that he used to be in Oaxaca. He is an extreme migrant, as I was saying. He is not clearly, he is what now people would call a colored person, but he is not an indigenous from Louisiana. He's not a black person. And he dresses like a white, educated person, but he is not recognized as such. And then, so that allows him to be in places that otherwise he wouldn't be allowed. And also, he is learning a language, and sometimes it's, as an adult, more than just knowing a language. The exercise of learning a language with the place, not on the books, that gives you a certain specific power to understand the place, because you are naming it. You are not just receiving the information about it. So the little English that he could have learned, he learned it on the streets. He learned it working. He learned it seeing the terrible things and the marvelous things that happened in the city. So that's an in-between that allows you to be perceptive to many other things. And as of what is happening right now, we can spend, and we should spend, a lot more time talking about this. I'm not sure where to start. What I would say is that Trump didn't invent racism. didn't invent these concentration camps or didn't invent cruelty. He is just shameless right now.
Mm.
Obama, with all his flair and all his coolness, was horrible to the migrant population of the United States. He built those cages that Trump is using. The main difference is that in other moment, I mean, there are many differences, but one very important difference is that in other moments, there was at least a certain illusion of decency. And what we have now is just a political class in which I include most of the media and most of the universities that have just accepted that cruelty and indecency is the way to go to reaffirm certain imaginary place of the United States in the world. And the expendable people to recreate this dream is the people that have been expendable all along. People of color, the migrants, the women, and the people who apparently cannot defend themselves. What I hope we are going to see a lot more is people actually defending themselves. It has happened in different cities with when you have these terrorists from ICE kidnapping people that you have seen communities coming out to help the migrants. And because they see what is happening, ICE is not going after criminals. They are going after people in hospitals, in courts, people who are trying to regularize their documents in their workplace. And they are going after people who are doing what a regular citizen does, work and take their children to school and go to court to try to work out their papers. This is also part of something else that has to do with the genocide in Palestine, with the invasion of Venezuela, with the horrors happening in Africa, which is the disappearance of a certain common law in the world. Mm. And that's why Trump says, I don't have to obey anyone. I just have to obey my own morality.
Yes.
And when a person who has been found of rape and who has bankrupted businesses many times, who has been outspoken racist, says the new order depends on my own morality, it's very clear what we are facing. And if there is one advantage, that's that we don't have to deal with the hypocrisy of Obama or Clinton or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they're the same thing. They had some advantages over this police criminal class that we have run. But at least they are not hiding that they are pirates stealing Venezuela's oil, that they are in favor of genocide, that they hate colored people, and that should give clarity when resisting and when rebelling against them.
No, absolutely. And Obama was the one who came up with that phrase, felons, not families, right? That there's a distinction between those properly attacked and those that should be immune. And that's all exploded, right? Because they've both literally and figuratively expanded the class of felons to everybody, right? Because they have actually put on the books more and more minor crimes that now become felonies, but also just in action, everybody is a felon. And after the murder of Good in Minneapolis, it doesn't matter your race anymore. It's just your posture, your presence at a particular place at a particular time is a threat, right? Just showing up.
They are calling anyone who opposes these kidnappings a domestic terrorist. They don't try to use euphemisms. They don't try to hide their intentions anymore. Probably this is gonna implode. But meanwhile, a lot of people is suffering because of this cynical way of grabbing power or, enrichment and for power itself.
You know, and it's the opposite of the kind of world that's opened up to Benito and New Orleans, which is multiplicity and mixedness and vibrancy and a hint of freedom. It's totalitarianism. It's basically saying what you're seeing with your eyes is not what you're seeing, right? It's not that. So instead of imagination and experimentation, you have the clamp down and the dictates of that. I want to maybe end with the great Aztlan, D.C., and I think it gets back to the idea of language. Isn't the line something that how, the last gringo president asks, how do you think in Mexican or something like that?
Yeah.
So take us through that. I'd like to know when you wrote it and then why you decided to revisit it and what's going on.
I wrote it more than 10 years ago.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
It seems so present, yeah.
I was... Let me see. No, it was more than 15 years ago. I was in Berkeley then, and I was just fantasizing the last day of the last American president, because he's about to just finish his period and there's going to be a Mexican president. And it's like, not only this person, the American president, can't understand why he lost, but he can't understand what are these people who are coming after him. And he keeps thinking what it is to think in Mexican.
Yeah.
And story, I wrote it in Spanish. It was translated and published in California. But I don't remember if I showed it to my translator, Lisa Dillman, or I talked with someone. No, I remember. I remember now. There was a professor who invited me in North Carolina for a talk many years ago, and he gave this story to his students. And some of them were really angry. They were really angry.
Good.
Especially because there's a line in which the Mexican president says, don't worry, everything is going to be fine. It's going to be the same. We're just going to find a real name for this country. Because United States of America, it's not a name. It's just the position in Google Maps. And they were just really mad about it. And recently, this guy, this professor, contacted me and he asked me, hey, are you planning to republish this? Because I think this would be a good moment. I was never really happy with that translation. So I sent it to my translator, Lisa Dillman, who already retranslated it. And we are thinking where to publish it. And I also sent it to a friend who was doing an anthology in Italy. And they were asking for a recent short story. And I said, you know what? I can send you something recent, but why don't you take a look at this? And they loved it. And it's going to be published also in Italian. Mm-hmm. The main thing to say is that this is not a nationalistic story about Mexicans taking over the United States. Because this is a story pretty much just making fun of all nationalities. Because I don't know if you remember at the end of the story, the Mexican president is not speaking Spanish.
He speaks French, right?
Yeah. And he doesn't look like a super powerful guy. He's a guy coming in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
But still, this guy coming in a wheelchair is the one who defeated this other. I don't always know what I'm saying when I'm writing literature. I just follow certain images and certain impulses. And I think that one could work right now.
No, I love it because it starts with municipalities, right? It starts with local ballot measures in cities.
In California,
which makes sense. And so it's a people's initiative. And as living in California, the proposition system is totally wacky, but interesting in its own way. But thank you so much for being on the show, Yuri. It's a pleasure to spend time with you and your comments. And I wish we had more time to talk about
the country.
The country.
I'm sure we will have more time to talk, even if it's not with the microphone.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Take care. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.